always have fun when I come. And today I'm happy to talk about some recent work I've done with my co-authors Antonis Varvatsiotis and Chiao-Hui Hui. And this talk is going to be based on these two papers. Okay, so the conic formulations can be found in this paper right here, posted last year, and the dimension bounds can be found in this paper. Okay. So just to give a quick outline of my talk. So the first thing I'm going to do is introduce all the definitions I'll work with. Okay. Then right after that, I'm going to throw all the definitions away and come up with my own. Okay, so alternative characterizations. And then I'm going to be talking about a physics application, dimension bounding. And then I'm going to be talking about a mathy perspective on how to look at quantum correlations. And then I'm going to wrap up with some open problems. Okay. At this point, feel free to interrupt with any questions or comments you may have. The last bit of my talk is broken up into little chunks, so I can stop at any time. So feel free to chat. And also, it's a pleasure. This is the most physics audience I've had for this talk. So if you have any suggestions or comments, I'm very happy to hear them. Okay. Okay. With all that said, this is what I'm going to be looking at. This kind of simple scenario. We have Alice. We have Bob. Okay, these are going to be the stars of the show. Okay, and they're going to share some kind of physical resource. Okay, it could be a source of shared randomness. For the most part, I'm going to be talking about entangled particles, and I'll briefly touch on no signaling correlations. But most of the time, you can just think of it as either shared randomness or quantum correlations. Okay, so what are they going to do with this? Well, they're going to measure it. Okay, so it's a pretty standard scenario. Just to set up some notation, Alice is going to have some finite set of measurements, okay, or measurement settings, I should say. Okay, for each measurement setting, there's going to be several POVM elements, several outcomes, and the outcomes are going to be indexed by this finite set A. And same for Bob. Bob is going to have some finite set of measurement settings T here, and each one is going to have given outcome given by this finite set B here. Okay, so just to see it in action here, Alice has chose to use measurement setting S, Bob has chose to use T, and then they do their physical operation, whatever it may be, and they get outcomes A and B. Okay, and what we're going to do is we want to look at all the sets of all these conditional joint probabilities here. So if Alice chose S and Bob chose T, then what are the probabilities, the joint probabilities of Alice getting A and B? So for this talk, for the most part, I'm going to be looking at these probabilities and what we can do with them, okay, and coming up, characterizing them and getting a better understanding of what happens, okay? So, but this will depend on the physical setting. Whoops, let's see. Okay, so I'm just gonna call these vectors correlations, okay? So we have four parameters here, A, B, S, T, for all the inputs and outputs. And at the basic level, we have to have that these each entry in this vector has to be non-negative because it corresponds to some probability. And also that they have to be proper probability distributions. So for any measurement settings Alice and Bob choose for S and T, the sum of AB has to be one. Okay? So these are honest to goodness probabilities. However, depending on the physical system that you use, you may not be able to generate all such probabilities. So each physical model is going to add additional constraints. Okay, so they're not always going to be so easy. So the first one, if they have shared randomness, okay, so they have a local correlation or classical, they'll say. And what they're going to do is they're going to have some kind of shared randomness indexed by this variable k here. So with probability ki, they both get some index I, some integer. Okay, and then if Alice gets I, then if she also chooses measurement setting S, she's going to output A with this probability here. So this is going to be a private randomness. And Bob has his private randomness here. And the randomness depends on the measurement setting and the shared randomness that they got. Okay, so if you can write the probabilities in this way, then it's a local correlation or a classical. Okay, and okay, now just ring quantum, where we're going to be looking at mostly. You just have this. So Alice and Bob have some shared quantum state here. It's on a bipartite system. And they each have measurements here. So for each S here, they have a POVM with outcome A. And same for Bob. Okay. And this is just the mathematical formalism. You just have a bunch of positive semi-definite matrices, some of them match the identity, and the trace equals one for the state. Okay, pretty standard. Okay. And this is the probability that both outcome A and B. And I'll also talk about no signaling correlations, but I'll just touch this briefly because I won't mention it too much. So Alice and Bob have some kind of box that's performing some kind of joint measurement or whatever, but the outcomes are guaranteed to be no signaling. Okay, so we say a probability correlation is no signaling if it satisfies these two conditions. And basically it just means that independent of Bob's input or measurement setting, Alice's local marginal probability should be preserved. On the other hand, if they were not preserved, Alice could perform some kind of statistics. She could analyze it and learn some information about Bob's input T. Okay? And she should not be able to do this. Okay? So this is no signaling from Bob to Alice, and this is no signaling from Alice to Bob. Okay? So there's no transmission of information faster than the speed of light. I guess I should say that Alice and Bob, you can assume that they're arbitrarily far away from each other. So there's some very, very long distance, some light years between them. Okay, so that's no signaling correlations. And just to kind of put them all into a picture, how do they relate to each other? Well, down here, you have the set of local correlations, or classical. This kind of looks like a C. Okay, this is a nice set. It's nice, it's well understood. The quantum set is a superset of that, and it's quite mysterious. Okay, so I'd like to gain a better understanding of what happens in the quantum set. Okay, no signaling is very easy. So this nice polytope here. Okay, and in the quantum, these local measurements preserve no signaling principle. So it's a subset of no signaling, and this you can think of this entire slide as being the set of all correlations. Okay, where there's no restrictions, just non-negative probabilities. Okay, so those are correlations. Why do we care about them? Well, there's the easy answer to gain a better understanding of quantum physics. Okay, so to understand non-locality, to understand what kind of tasks can you do or perform with quantum entanglement, these kind of things. So this is the easy answer. My personal reason is because there's neat optimization problems. So most of my research involves looking at problems in quantum computation or physics or cryptography or whatever, and I analyze it using optimization theory. Okay, so this is my personal reason for getting into this, because there's very neat optimization problems that come into play. Okay, and we'll touch on this later in the talk. And also in cryptography, just to give a concrete application, so we can have key distribution. So key distribution, if Alice and Bob want to generate a one-time pad and send secret messages to each other. You can use this using no signaling ideas. You can also have device independent implementations. Okay, this is where Alice and Bob communicate or do some kind of information task, but they don't trust the device. Okay, the device could even be implemented by someone who's malicious, like an eavesdropper. Okay, can you still get some kind of security? And sometimes the answer is yes, and the answer is from non-locality. Another one is relativistic bit commitment. So if Alice and Bob are light years apart, maybe not light years, but there's some kind of distance, and they want to perform some kind of cryptographic task, how secure it is can depend on the limits of quantum non-locality. Okay? But in general, many problems, whether it's in mathematics or whatever, you can pose as a question of having an Alice and a Bob who can't communicate and testing them with questions. Okay, so there's many mathematical problems that can be asked in this framework just by having an Alice and Bob. And then you ask the question, what if they share in quantum entanglement? Okay. Okay. Any questions so far? Okay, so that's the setup. The first thing I want to do is come up with alternative characterizations. Okay, so the definitions for local correlations or quantum correlations, they seemed quite different. Okay, so now I want to find some unified way of looking at both of them, so I can do something with them. So here's a new algebraic characterization. A correlation is quantum if and only if there exist these positive semi-definite matrices over here, EXA and FYB. So these are indexed by Alice's inputs. Oh, I just realized there's a spelling. So X and S are the same thing. Okay, so these are indexed by Alice's measurement settings and outcomes, and these are indexed by Bob's measurement settings and outcomes. And now, if this probability can be written as this inner product, just the trace inner product, of these two positive semi-definite operators, and if it satisfies this condition down here, then it's a quantum correlation. Okay? So it's already cleaned up a little bit, because before we had some kind of cubic polynomial thing, but now we just have something that's quadratic. So it's a little bit cleaner. But these E's and F's, they're not POVMs anymore. Before, I had this condition that they added to the identity. But now, they don't have to add to the identity, but they have to have some kind of normalization down here. So for each S, if you sum over these A's here, they have to be the same matrix. And similarly over here, if you sum over all the B's, for each T, it has to be the same matrix. So right now I'm assuming it's a correlation. It'd be written like this. Okay, so if you want the normalization to equal this equal one, you can just say that the two norm of this sum equals one. Yeah. Right now I'm assuming that this is a correlation and this is also a correlation right here. Yeah, so it's implied. Okay, and to get to classical, we just have to change a few things. So now it's classical, but instead of positive semi-definite operators, we now just have non-negative vectors. Okay? And we just change the capital E's to small E's and the capital F's to small F's, and you have the exact same theorem. Okay? And then this is true quite often, I find. Whenever you just go from probabilities to density operators, you just change vectors, non-negative vectors, to positive semi-definite matrices. Okay? So this is already kind of a unified way of looking at classical and quantum correlations. And actually, this is quite easy to prove. It's basically just some algebraic manipulation. It's not some deep mathematics. But what's nice is already with this new perspective, we can actually prove something interesting. Okay, so this brings me to the first application, dimension bounds. So here's a question. If I give you a quantum correlation, what is the smallest Hilbert space that you need to generate this correlation? Okay, so from the definition, we had that these P's here, they have to exist some bipartite quantum state that's living in some Hilbert space, and there has to exist these POVMs. But at the end of the day, the definition takes all this information, whether this works on 1 qubit or 100 qubits, and takes the trace. Okay, so all this dimension information is kind of swept under the rug, because we're just end up with a non-negative scalar. So the question is, how small can these guys be if you have a quantum correlation? Okay, does that question make sense? Okay, so here's a theorem. Any correlation, you think quantum correlation if you want, you need a state of local dimension, at least this quantity, okay? So Alice and Bob both need to have a Hilbert space of dimension at least this large. Okay. And what's neat about this is that this is a function that only depends on P, only on the probabilities themselves. Okay. So if you were to give me the probabilities, I could just compute this. It looks a little nasty, but it's quite a nice function. So there's some square roots or some sums or some finite mins and maxes, but it's pretty simple to compute. Okay, you can easily do this on your computer.
Imagine you just had, if Bob had a one-dimensional Hilbert space, then how would you look at that from that point of view? Because then it's got to be a product state. So all the dimensional stuff.
That's right. So the first thing that we do here is that you can actually assume that Alice and Bob have the same dimension in Hilbert space. Okay. And you can just do this by taking some Schmidt decomposition, doing some isometries and stuff like that. Because so you take the Schmidt decomposition. If one of them has a Hilbert space larger than the other, then you, there's some extra dimensions they don't need.
What if, you know, S takes one through to N?
Yeah, so these are actually just the measurement settings. This has nothing to do with the dimension.
Yeah, but it could be that Alice preparing a set of distinguishable basis things.
And then
A just reads off the value of that. So you need at least.
You mean by performing the measurement?
Yeah, so essentially Bob becomes irrelevant. Alice prepares one of a set of N states,
mm-hmm.
and then reads it off. So it would seem that you need at least N, dimension N, to characterize what's happening there. So I guess you're not doing that.
So this is just if they share a state. They already have a state. And in a product state, then you would need dimension 1. Because there's nothing really quantum happening then. Because then you just have some kind of private randomness that's happening from the outcome.
You said a product state, but it seems like you'd say like the story that if PAB given ST factorizes as PA given S times PB given T, then when you plug it into your formula, I think you get 1, doesn't it? Like, if I don't observe any correlations for any settings, then one-dimensional systems are sufficient to explain that.
That could be true. So this thing actually, if you can write this as a product, this whole thing just multiplies. So you might be able to get that.
I think so, because if PA given S squares, you sum over A plus 1, and you're left with PB given T, PB prime given T prime, and you sum over B and B prime, they go to 1.
Yeah, it could be.
So you get 1.
You get 1.
Okay. So this is really, you're really looking at the Schmidt coefficient here. Understand what you mean by the dimension of the state.
If you use the average state, it doesn't have to be with this recovered gas or state that generated correlation. Rather, I'd say there's another way to get this correlation.
Mm-hmm. But I can't think of any way to get a correlation where, other than using an n-dimensional system. If my states are, Bob just has the state 1,
mm-hmm.
whereas Alice has the state 1, 2, 3, or 4. Okay, and she chooses whatever S she chooses, and S can be 1, 2, 3, or 1, and that
mm-hmm.
And then she just measures onto those states.
Yep.
So it seems like she needs at least a 4-dimensional. For the space to describe us,
she can just use classical randomness.
Oh, okay. So this is classical. So classical randomness could be used in the background.
This actually includes classical randomness. Yeah.
Or they don't share classical randomness, but they just the fact that you're allowing them to likely use P at the end means that they can likely have randomness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, that's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
So, just a general question. Is there something known for nucleotide systems? So, if you ask the same question about the dimensions of the
system, so there's two things I can say about that. One is this proof does not work for three or more parties, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So, the whole thing actually boils down to taking a Schmidt decomposition at the very beginning.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is unfortunate. I can come up with some stuff, but it's not fully general, unfortunately. It depends on having a Schmidt-like decomposition. And second of all, I'm not aware of any results that are like this. There's a series of work on dimension witnesses. And dimension witnesses, basically you have a Bell inequality or something like this. And then they say, if your state satisfies some condition, then they cannot be generated by, say, a two-dimensional Hilbert space. So usually these are very specific to both a Bell inequality and an actual number. Like it can't be two-dimensional or it can't be three-dimensional. Whereas this is just a function of the probabilities themselves and it just gives you a lower bound, just some number. Yeah. So it's a little more general in that sense. But yeah. Any other questions? Okay. So let me just give an example of the PR box. So this can give you a finite lower bound, but it can also give you an infinite bound. So now I'm going to prove that the pure box is not quantum, okay, using our lower bound. So what is the pure box? Well, right here, the probability is 1/2. So, okay, let me start again. If they input either 0, 0, 0, 1, or 1, 0, then they're going to output the same, exact same quantity, okay? It's going to be random. And if they both input 1, 1, they're going to output different quantities. Okay, so standard pure box. And this is a correlation, okay? But it's no signaling, but it's not quantum. Okay, so it's somewhere in between. But still, it's a nice correlation. It satisfies all the properties we want. And what I'm going to do is give a short proof that it's not quantum. So here's our lower bound. What we're going to do is make use of this little guy up here, this -1, and use that to show. Okay, so basically, everything on the inside here, if we can evaluate that guy to 0, then we have 1/0. Okay, so that's bad. So to do this, we have the luxury of choosing two different t's. So we're going to choose t, the first one to be 0 and the second one to be 1. So two different inputs. And show for everything in that sum that this minimum here equals 0. Okay. So it's not actually that hard to do by hand. Okay. Well, for such a small example. So here's the correlation matrix. So I'm going to reorder the vector into a matrix now. Okay. I'll need this later on as well. So it's going to be a block. It's indexed by S and A over here and T and B upstairs here. So this first block row is S equals 0. Down here is S equals 1. And this is T equals 0 and T equals 1. Okay. And all the probabilities are stuck into this matrix. Now to evaluate this lower bound, we're just going to be looking at this block column and this block column separately because there's two different choices of T. And first we're going to look at these two choices of B. Now this is just saying the first column in each. So you take this inner product between these two. Well, it's kind of like an inner product, you take square roots, but basically the inner product between these two, that's whenever S equals 0. And when S equals 1, you get this guy. And we see that that inner product is 0. So the minimum is attained at S equals 1. So we're done. That equals 0. And you can do the same trick for the second choice of B's here. So now you're comparing this column over here and this column over here, because B prime equals 1 now. You take the two inner products between those guys and those guys, and it's attained at 0, and they're orthogonal again. So it evaluates to 0. Okay, and you can do this for the other two choices of B, and we see it always attains 0. Okay, so for all B, this minimum here equals 0. Okay, and this is something you can, once you get the hang of it, it's very easy to check. You just write down the matrix and you just kind of start sliding your fingers around and making sure that all the inner parts are 0. Okay, so the pure box is now quantum.
If you had a quantum realization of the pure box, then it will have an infinite dimension.
Yes. Yeah, so to be very precise, what I'm ruling out is finite dimensional Hilbert spaces to generate the pure box. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Don't you know that even in
an infinite
dimensional
space,
you can't have
the
pure box?
That's right. So this only rules out finite dimensional. That's right. Yeah.
Is no signaling built into this theorem? Where does this theorem come from?
So it just uses this algebraic characterization that I came up with at the beginning, that if it's quantum, then it's equal to this inner product of two positive semidefinite matrices. And the proof is actually quite short to generate this lower bound. It's very short. It's inspired by the study of this PSD rank in computer science. Yeah, which is some of the co-authors are familiar with this work. Yeah.
Is there a similar theorem in classical?
That's a very good question, and that's something I'm investigating now. We can generate, obviously, the same lower bound, because the lower bound on quantum generates a lower bound on the classical. And the proof actually holds in the classical setting as well. Everything can go through, but I don't know how to tighten it at any of the reductions. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have any
use your alternate characterization to describe no signal correlations? Something like
I will get to that later in the talk. Yeah, but it, no signaling is kind of a different beast, as far as I know, or at least I haven't found the right perspective to look at it. Classical and quantum seem to be very similar in some ways, but with no signaling, a lot of our theorems only hold for classical and quantum. Yeah, we kind of shoehorn no signaling in later, as I'll discuss later. But yeah. Any other questions? Okay. Okay, so I'll just say this. The lower bound actually ends up being tight on quite a few examples. In general, we don't believe it's going to be tight, but a lot of things that we threw at it end up giving exactly tight lower bounds. So for correlations generated by CHSH and the magic square game, if you know what those are, our lower bound gives the optimal thing. For CHSH, it's a Hilbert space of dimension 2, and for magic square, it's dimension 4. Okay. And I'll be talking more about these non-local games later, but if you know what those are, it's tight there. And also, you can rule out sets of correlations. So I had the Pirra box, but you can generalize Pirra box to more general boxes. And it also rules these out. Okay? Not all of them, specific examples. And this is a game that I was interested in, and I can show there's no perfect strategies. So, which is, I'll say this in another way, if you have families of correlations and they satisfy some properties, sometimes our correlation, our lower bound can show that can't be quantum. Yeah. So surprisingly, it worked out to be tight on all these examples. And I'll just say this briefly. So the thing is, in the laboratory, you cannot generate these correlations perfectly. Okay. So suppose you put on your goggles, your lab coat, and you warm up your lasers, and you start generating these correlations. Okay? Or the experimentalists will do this. And at the end of the day, you're gathering all these statistics, you get together, you calculate these joint probability distributions. But the thing is, this probability distribution is not going to be the exact one, okay, that describes your quantum system. Okay? So there's going to be some error. However, what you can do is take your estimate, or whatever the probability distribution is, and plug it into the lower bound. Okay? You'll get some number, it won't be perfect, but you'll get some lower bound on the state of your dimension. And it'll be a reasonable estimate, because let's say each of these probabilities you can get within 1% or 0.1% or whatever the technology allows at the time. Right here, since this is composed of very simple functions, you can just do some simple calc 1 bounding, and you can bound each one of these functions individually and get a reasonable estimate. Okay? So suppose you have a pretty good estimation what the actual p is. You calculate this, let's say it gives you 15. Okay, it says the lower bound is actually 15. Well, in reality, with the confidence level you have of peer of your estimate, maybe the lower bound is actually 13 or something like this. And you can compute the discrepancy between the two bounds. So it's a nice feature of the fact that they're simple functions.
Can't imagine putting an epsilon amount of, I'm kind of worried about the continuity of the change in the dimension bound based on changes in the correlation.
So what I was thinking is that each of these probabilities is within, say, 1%, or within epsilon of the true probability. So I'm bounding the total, the maximum amount it varies.
And you have a result that says for things that are connected by epsilon, the dimension will be connected?
No, but I calculated some stuff at one point, and it all works out. You can bound each of these quite simple, and you can do this.
Although I don't think this will happen, but if you could do some small deviation that would get you to non-quantum correlations, mm-hmm. then your bound goes from something finite to infinity.
And not quite.
Yep.
So this is a lower bound for any correlation. You can calculate for any correlation. But if it steps outside the quantum set, it doesn't necessarily give you plus infinity. The lower bound does not always evaluate to plus infinity if it's not quantum.
But it would seem to me that although that might not always happen, if it can sometimes happen, and that's a concern for the continuity of this argument, like, what if small deviations in the observed correlation lead to a jump of the lower bound to infinity?
Yeah.
It seems to me that's the kind of thing you want to check.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, so our lower bound will only give zero if there's some zeros in this probability. So it would not be a problem if the probabilities were all positive and you bounded this epsilon by some quantity to make sure it doesn't hit zero. But in that special case, I'm not quite sure. I'd have to think about it a bit more. But
odd about that response, though, is that in a sense you're relying on a deficiency of your bound. Right? If your bound were better, and as soon as I went above zero sin amount, it said infinity, then that would be a better bound.
Yes.
And then you would be more likely to have these continuity issues. But given that that doesn't happen for your bound, you're saying, oh, I'm less likely to have these continuity issues. But right, so you know, suppose I do an experiment so well, but due to statistical deviations, my mm-hmm. observed correlations are actually a bit above zero sin amount. Maybe I haven't taken enough data. Mm-hmm. So then when I plug it in to not your bound, but some, you know, better bound that could register that, and we expect to get infinity, mm-hmm. which would be not epsilon close to the actual bound, which would be some kind of...
You look for the smallest one, right? You're interested in what's the smallest dimension that gives you a correlation close to one, right? So the fact that you sometimes get infinity, that's not the problem.
Yeah, so you could. I'm thinking that you do the error analysis, right? And it's not that for any correlation, if you're error is at most epsilon, then you would deviate in the guessed dimension by, let's say, you know, 100 epsilon, whatever it is. But rather, if you happen to have zeros in there, then when you do the error analysis with epsilon, it'll say, well, now the uncertainty in the dimension is infinity. Because you could run this with a finite epsilon, and if there's zeros in your distribution, you could say, it has an uncertainty. So you could get like a finite value of an uncertainty.
Yeah, but I would say that if your variance, if your uncertainty was infinity, that would be a very good bound. Whereas I think what Matt was suggesting, if I'm not mistaken, is that if you said something like, find the minimum dimension bound of all observed correlations that are within an epsilon ball of the actual statistics, then if you got a few infinities in there because some of your, you know, something in that epsilon ball violates the zero sum bound, then you're okay because you're looking for the minimum.
Yep.
But it sounded to me like you're more doing a kind of plus or minus at the end. You know, this is the dimension bound plus or minus some range. Was I wrong?
Let's see. Yeah, I think I was doing what both of you guys are saying.
Okay.
If I believe so. So you want to make this decrease. So I was just looking at how much maximum it could decrease. And it could be zero at some points. In this case, it would give plus infinity. Yeah. But assuming it was positive, you could easily bound it. I don't remember what the bounding was. I just scratched on some paper. But yeah, I'll think about some more. Any other questions with this? Okay, so I want to talk about some conic formulations. So now what I want to do is look at the structure of the sets of classical correlations, quantum correlations, and kind of look at it from a mathematical point of view. Okay, so just picture, this is what I care about. What I want to do is look at these convex cones. Okay, so this is some mathematical structure. This will shoot up to infinity, okay? And what a cone is, a convex cone, is you can think of it as a set of matrices for this talk. So it's a set of matrices such that if you're given a point in the set and you scale it by a non-negative scalar, it remains in the set. Okay? So down here will be the origin. Okay? So you could scale it by a small constant, and it'll go down towards zero, or a large constant, and it'll shoot up towards plus infinity, and it's still contained in the set. So it's closed under that operation. And also, if you were to take two matrices in the set and add them together, it remains in the set. OK? Okay, so basically it's convex. If you connect two points, it's still in the set. My favorite convex cone is the set of positive semidefinite matrices. Okay, so if you're given a positive semidefinite matrix and you scale it by a non-negative scalar, it's still positive semidefinite. And if you add two together, it's still positive semidefinite. Okay, so this is going to be a cone, and we're going to look at an affine slice of the cone. Okay, so this is not a linear space. It doesn't go through the zero, but it's going to be some nice hyperplane. And we're going to look at the intersection right here of these two sets. Okay, so this is some kind of mathematical object, and I want to use this to capture the set of quantum correlations. Okay, so that's where I'm going. So I'll introduce some cones of interest, some sets of matrices. So I'm going to introduce four or five sets. You won't have to memorize all the definitions. I just want to give you a flavor of the sets I'm interested in and how they arise. Okay. So first, there's the set of Hermitian positive semidefinite matrices, which I'll denote by H. Okay, so this is a nice set. Here's another set, completely positive. A matrix is completely positive if and only if there exist these vectors, A1 through AN. So this is an n by n matrix. So n non-negative vectors living in some space D here, such that the entries in X are just the inner products of the vectors. Okay. And just to touch base with this definition, if you were to remove this non-negativity constraint, you would get a positive semidefinite matrix. This is exactly the definition of positive semidefinite, but now we require that they're non-negative. Okay. And before I continue, this has nothing to do with completely positive superoperators. Okay. I get this question a lot. This is just some notion of matrices that shows up in optimization literature quite often. It happened to also show up in quantum literature, but I have no idea if there's any relationship between the two. Okay. So just forget about the standard quantum completely positive and just remember this for the rest of the talk. So another set. AA non-negative. These are positive semidefinite matrices with non-negative entries. Okay, so these matrices, they're AA non-negative. There's two flavors of non-negativity, both the entries and the eigenvalues. Okay, so they're really non-negative.
That means that there are non-matrices with non-negative components. Don't have non-negative eigenvalues for which?
That don't have, yeah, you can just take 1, 2, 2, 1. Yeah. Yes, but not positive semidefinite. And right here, completely positive semidefinite. So this is going to be the cone I'm going to focus on the most, and it'll have some kind of quantum context I'll get to later. So completely positive semidefinite is whenever there exists the n positive semidefinite matrices now, such that the entries in the matrix equals the trace inner product between the two. Okay, so before I had non-negative vectors, and I'm going to replace them with these positive semidefinite matrices. Okay, and this is a very new cone. It was very newly introduced. And I'll talk about it more in a second. And right here, I'm also not specifying how large the matrices are. I'm just saying there exists D by D matrices of any dimension, such that when you take the trace, you get the matrix elements. Okay. And an easy one to end off with, non-negative and symmetric matrices. Okay, so everything's just non-negative, the entries. And just to have some conclusions, right here we have completely positive matrices. This is contained in the set of completely positive semi-definite matrices. You can always just put the non-negative vector on the diagonal, and then you have a positive semidefinite matrix. And if you take the inner product of positive semidefinite matrices, you always get something non-negative. So, and you still get something positive semidefinite. So it's in doubly non-negative. And all these guys are contained in the largest set, which is just non-negative. Well, the largest one I consider. So then we have cones that are contained in each other. And in a few slides, I'll relate it to the sets that were contained in each other, classical correlations, quantum correlations, et cetera. Okay? So That's why I'm introducing them. Okay, so some properties of this cone. Right here, this is easy to optimize over and easy to test. So if I give you a matrix, it's quite easy to tell whether it's non-negative eigenvalues and non-negative entries. Okay. And over here, well, it's even easier. You just have to test the entries. But these two guys are very hard. If I give you a matrix and I ask you if it's completely positive or completely positive indefinite, it's a very hard question to answer. Okay, so these are tricky cones, but they're very interesting. Okay, hopefully by the end of the talk, I'll convince you of this. Okay, so a little bit more about this cone. Completely positive semi-definite. It was introduced about 2 years ago, and it was to give conic formulations for quantum graph parameters. Okay, so what people did, they took questions in combinatorics, say if you're given a graph, and you're given three colors, and you want to know, can you color the graph with three colors? Okay, so you're going to color each of the vertices, and if they're connected by an edge, they have to have a different color. The question whether there exists a three coloring of a graph or not can be posed as a game, okay, in the Bell scenario. And then you ask, well, can you win this in a quantum way? Is there a quantum three coloring of a graph? Okay, and deciding whether these things are true or not gives rise to these quantum graph parameters and solving a conic formulation. Okay, so they were introduced in a quantum context. Now, it's not known if this is closed. So if you have a sequence of completely positive semi-definite matrices and they converge onto a point, is that point positive semi-definite or not? Okay, so I think that's an interesting problem. And it's hard to test. If I give you a linear system and I ask, is there a solution to the system such that it's in that the matrix that's a solution is also in this cone, then it's NP hard. It's a very hard thing to test. Okay. And unfortunately, or fortunately, there's no upper bound known on the dimension of the PST factors. I said that these matrices have to exist, but I didn't say how large they had to be. And as of now, we have no idea how large they can be. Okay, so if you have a 5x5 matrix or 6x6, you can't. You might need 100x100 matrices to generate it. We have no known upper bound. Exponential, double exponential, nothing. Okay. Okay. So all this talk about matrices, let's bring it back to the quantum context. What we're going to do is consider matrices of this shape. And why this shape? Well, we have, this little submatrix here is what we're interested in. And it's indexed by SNA and TMB. So this right here is exactly the right size to hold all the probabilities in a correlation. Okay. However, it's not a symmetric matrix. It may not even be square. So we're going to make it square just by tacking on these extra spaces. So now we have SA and TB. So now this whole thing has room to be a symmetric matrix. So if you have matrices of this shape, what we're going to do is define a K correlation. Now a K correlation, K is going to be some convex cone. Okay? You can think of it as having non-negative entries. And we're going to say it's a K correlation if it satisfies these two conditions. Okay? And I'll just describe what they are with my hands. Basically, the entries up here has to be a valid correlation. So if you look at the submatrix indexed by S and T right here, you'll get a little submatrix, and all those entries have to add to 1, okay? Just as in the correlation, and they have to be non-negative from the cone. However, we're going to also assume that it holds over here, which I have no physical interpretation of at this moment, and also down here. So this whole thing is split up into these submatrices, and each one has to add to 1. Okay, that's what this is saying. And you can just interpret this block now as being a correlation, a K correlation. And this entire matrix has to be in the cone. Okay. So this is definitely a subset of all correlations because I'm adding this cone constraint. Okay. And I'm going to denote this set of correlations as core K, where K is the convex cone, and we're going to change it around. Are there any questions about this definition? X, yes, 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 yes. X is this whole matrix, and it has to live in the cone K. And this SATB is just this block up here. Yeah. And the J's just add up the sublocks. I didn't define what J is. It's pretty messy. They add sublocks. So if you just pick out an S, you pick out a T, you'll have a submatrix. And then you just add them all up and they have to add to one. Just as in a correlation. Yeah. So J is the matrix of all ones, basically. OK, so to talk about some geometry, a correlation is classical if and only if it is a completely positive correlation. Okay, so if that matrix on the last slide, if it has to fall into this matrix cone, then it's also a classical correlation. Okay? If you open up the cone just a little bit more, and you have completely positive semi-definite matrices now, these correlations correspond exactly to the quantum correlations. And now to partially answer your question, you have another cone here, which I haven't defined. It doesn't really deserve a definition at this point because basically it's just enforcing that marginals are preserved. But anyway, you can define this nice polyhedral cone. And if it's in that, then it's a no-signaling correlation. And if you open up the cone all the way and you have just a set of all matrices that have non-negative entries, you get all correlations, or I say unrestricted.
Matrix of some x which is in the cone.
That's right. Okay. So p is in the top right, and you have to fill in the rest.
And so this core function is like taking the top right corner of some element of that cone.
Exactly. Okay. To say it precisely, it's a projection of an affine slice of the cone. Yep. Mm-hmm. Do I have a what? Sorry.
For almost quantum conditions?
No. No. I will get to some, I will almost answer your question in a few slides. Yes. Any other questions with this? Okay, so one neat thing is at the beginning, all these definitions were kind of weird. You had the classical correlations, quantum correlations, no signaling, and each one had to be gone through separately. They're kind of different. But right here, all we have is we have some nice affine slice, okay? And we have different cones. We're keeping the same slice, and we just have a small cone, you have classical correlations. You open it up a bit more, you get quantum. You open it up a little bit more, you get no signaling. And if you open it all the way, you get all correlations. So it's a very nice unified way of looking at all these correlations, and all you're doing is changing the shape of the cone. And if I didn't convince you at the beginning that the picture with classicals containing quantum, quantums contain no signaling, and so forth, this is another much harder proof of showing these set containments of that picture. Okay? But it's a nice sanity check, because we are recovering that nice picture. So, and there's some consequences. So there's some direct mathematical relationships between these guys. So these three cones are closed. Okay? They contain all the limit points. And these three sets are closed. But we don't know if the set of quantum correlations is closed or not. Okay, you know, the mathematician in me cares about this problem. I don't think a lot of physicists would actually care. If you can get arbitrarily close, it might be good enough. But and still, if we're able to show that this set right here was closed, this would just imply by a continuity argument that the set of quantum correlations is closed. Okay, so we took a bit of an older problem and we phrased it in terms of these new mathematical concepts. Okay, and there's a lot of mathematical connections between these guys. Okay, so now I want to talk about some applications of these conic formulations. The first thing I want to talk about is efficient approximations. Okay? So by efficient approximations, basically what I'm going to do is take these cones that are hard to test or optimize over and replace them with something that's easier. Okay? And usually by easy, we use the set of just regular positive semi-definite matrices. Okay? So this is why I put SDP here. So inner and outer approximations, semi-definite programming just means you're using the cone of positive semi-definite, which is easy to test. And quantum correlations are kind of a nasty set. Okay, Maybe I should say mysterious. Let's keep it positive. So now we want to find approximations of this mysterious set. Okay, and there's been a body of work on this. So these three guys, I'll just refer to them collectively as NPA. So there's this NPA hierarchy that shown SDPs that approximates the set of quantum correlations. Okay, so what does this do? Well, you have the set of quantum correlations, but it's hard. Maybe you're given a correlation, you want to know if it's quantum or not. What you can do is solve this slightly weaker problem of whether it's in this relaxed set. So there's the quantum set, here's the first level of the hierarchy. Now this is something you can efficiently test. You can solve it on your computer, okay, assuming it's not too big of a problem. And you can test whether it's in the set or not. Now maybe this isn't a close enough approximation, so you can go up the hierarchy, so you go to the second level. Now the set is going to close in a little bit. The problem is going to be a little bit harder to solve, but you're getting closer to the quantum set. Okay? And as you go up the hierarchy, you get closer and closer to the quantum set. But the problem is going to grow very large. Okay? So you don't want to go up too large. Okay, so anyway, and it's also not known if this actually converges on the set of quantum correlations. Okay? I said onto the set of quantum correlations. Yeah, I believe it converges on the field theoretic value, but it's not known whether that converges or not. There's some deep operational theoretical problems with whether it converges onto Q or not. Yeah, yeah, and all these Kahn's embedding conjectures and all there's a lot of business there. Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, not saying it's bad, it's very good. The proof converges for convergence, some properties and stuff, but in general, it doesn't converge on the set of quantum correlations. At best, it converges onto the field theoretic value, which is something slightly different than what I'm talking about. Yep. We can chat more later if you want. Yep. Okay, so to carry on with these efficient approximations, what I'm going to do is now let K be anything in this set, DNN, doubly non-negative, so it's positive semi-definite, non-negative entries. And if it's in there, then the set of correlations that corresponds to this convex cone is contained in the set of no signaling correlations. Okay? So that's nice, now we have two nice sets. And since this cone right here is contained in doubly non-negative, we get that the correlations corresponding to this, which exactly correspond to quantum, is contained in this set right here. And this set is contained in no signaling. Okay, so we've already made a little bit of progress from just the information contained in my slides. The best upper bound we have is no signaling on the set of quantum correlations. And now we have something that fits in between the two. So that's something, I guess.
Do you know that those are strict conditions?
Well, I'll say this first and then. So actually what we can do is show that the set of these correlations, DNN correlations, which is efficiently testable, is contained in the first level of the NPA1 hierarchy. Okay. And but I believe this is very close. Okay, this containment, we couldn't show equality, but I believe they're very close in general. So to get back to your question, it's probably the case that this does not perform as well as the almost quantum set. Because the almost quantum set takes a pretty good chunk out of NPA1, if I remember, yeah. But nonetheless, this is a very nice set. This is a very nice thing you can ask your computer to solve. You just have a matrix, you just say this adds to one, this adds to one, this adds to one. Make the whole thing positive semi-definite, non-negative entries. Go solve, okay? So it's a very easy way of, even conceptually easy, just to ask your computer to solve. And I'll speak more about this set in a bit, but I want to introduce non-local games first. Ooh, okay. I guess I'll be introducing this very quickly. So non-local games. So we have a referee. He's going to ask questions to Alice and Bob. So Alice is going to get question S, Bob's going to get question T with some known probability. You're going to use some physical resource here, whether it be shared randomness or entanglement, to generate answers A and B. and he's going to decide whether they win or lose, depending only on ABST. So he has some deterministic function that depends only on these four values, and he's going to say win or lose. Okay. And in the interest of time, I'm just going to fly through this a little bit. So they want to maximize the probability that they win using quantum correlations. And you can pose this as optimizing a linear function over those sets that we had before. Okay, the set. So this is optimizing the game over the set of classical correlations, quantum correlations, no signaling, and all correlations. Okay, so now we actually have an optimization problem that is a very common structure that you can solve for entangled value of games or these other values. And if you open up any textbook in optimization theory, you can see lots and lots of theory on this structure of optimization. Yeah. And these are exact characterizations, which is nice. And looking before these other approximations, when you optimize it, you get a semi-definite program. And you actually get, so this is the quantum value of a game. And over here, you get some STP that's efficiently solvable. It does a little bit better than the MPA-1 hierarchy, well, at least weakly better. It doesn't do worse. And one neat thing is that this STP actually shows up in the literature about 25 years ago or so in a Stock 92 paper by Faghi and Lovash. And they introduced it as an upper bound on the classical value of a game. Okay? So the classical value fits over here. And it was not known whether this was an upper bound on the quantum value or not. Okay? In fact, some people guessed that they were completely incomparable. Okay? But this is just immediate consequence of our formulation. We can easily show just by some Cohen inclusions that this guy is also an upper bound on the quantum value. Okay, I should wrap up. Okay, so these are just some other consequences of having some mathematical formalism in optimization theory of talking about non-local games. Okay, and I'll just quickly say this. We first started at these quantum conic formulations for quantum chromatic number and stability number, which I mentioned briefly before, whether you want to quantumly color a graph of three colors. This is our starting point. Okay, so we're able to have multiple layers of generalization, and then after we restrict it, we actually get back to our starting point. Okay. So I'll just quickly say some open problems. Can we upper bound the Hilbert space dimension needed to generate a quantum correlation? I presented a lower bound. Can we also have an upper bound? Okay. It's interesting, right? So I don't know how to do this. It would be very interesting. And can we prove the set of quantum correlations is closed? Okay. If we can put an upper bound up here, this follows immediately. Okay. There's a compactness argument. And can we prove anything interesting about the set of completely positive semi-definite matrices? Okay. So this is a mathematical way of restating these problems. For example, can we bound the size of the matrices in the decomposition? Okay. And this is something I'm quite interested in. We have some partial progress, so some future work. So there's a paper that appears on the archive hopefully soon, completely positive semi-definite rank. This is where we look at these matrices and we upper and lower bound the sizes of the matrices in the decomposition. Okay. So there's some partial progress there. I also want to apply dimension bounding to the prepare and measure setting. Okay. So this is not quite a Bell scenario, but it's something quite related. Okay, and we already have some dimension bounds. We're just looking at some applications now. So if anyone here knows or is interested in prepare and measure, please come chat with me. I'd be interested to hear. And to find other models which we can apply the study of completely positive semi-definite matrices. Now this set does not just work only for Bell scenarios, but there's many other scenarios it works for. Okay, so I'd like to see what else we can do and if we can say something interesting in the other settings. Okay, and thanks for listening.
Yeah? There's a step in your argument in there that I missed when you introduced the cone associated with non-signaling correlation.
Yes.
Called NSO. And at the time I thought you said I'm going to come to it, but then maybe I didn't
So I came to it and then I quickly went away. What I did, this cone is basically, it's very contrived. It's basically just adding the entries in the cone such that they're preserved. So you have this block adds to some constant, this block adds to some constant, this block adds to some constant. And they correspond to the marginal probability distributions. So it's just adding.
Using the definition.
Yeah, it's just basically using the definition. That's why I didn't bother defining it. It doesn't really deserve a definition. But to get back to your earlier question, is there some kind of nice framework where we can actually put no signaling correlations? And I'm not quite sure. We thought about it, and the classical and the quantum correlations have some nice structure. Like, for example, whenever you look at the matrices, they're positive semi-definite. Now, I wasn't able to find an equivalent characterization for no signaling that kind of fit into this framework, where the resulting matrix has to be positive semi-definite. So at the beginning, I had this completely positive, it's contained in completely positive semi-definite, and those are both contained in DNN, doubly non-negative. Now, doubly non-negative has some nice structure to it that I was able to prove these things, but there wasn't another cone that fit, that was small enough, that fit into DNN that also captured no signaling.
And yet later you have that on the games, you have bounds for non-signaling on the right, but DNN is perfectly within that.
So yeah, you can prove that classical correlations and quantum correlations are no signaling, but even something a little bit larger. And if you just look at these DNN correlations, and anything with a DNN correlation, you could prove is no signaling. And it basically boiled down to having this Gram decomposition, if you look at it as a Gram matrix. If it had that structure, you could prove that just by some simple stuff that is non-signaling. Yeah. So yeah, no signaling, it comes into play, but it doesn't fit in as nicely as I would have liked it to. Yeah.
I think you get the no signaling set, you just take the classical set and drop the positives.
Not sure what that means.
So you take the definition of classical correlations.
Yeah, yeah.
And you just take required probabilities and factor out.
Is that no signaling? Can you get pure box that way?
Yeah. It's equivalent to just taking Hermitian matrices. Because you can always think of your Hermitian matrices as just vectors in a real vector space. So
oh.
Either real vectors or Hermitian matrices.
Oh, I see.
Either,
I see.
Either one.
Yeah.
You can get through that definition.
I see. Yeah. Yeah, I'll think if that works in analysis. Yeah. Yeah, thanks. Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I missed the lecture, but I read on the website, perimeter, it sounded interesting, like quantum games. Sorry, I missed it, but I have a question, if that's okay.
Yeah, I don't mind.
So on the internet, you see like this thing about this celebrity playing quantum chess with Stephen Hawking. So the quantum version of games is more different because you can, once you have a superposition, you could have moves that weren't allowed before, are allowed, but only in superposition, so that's a type of entanglement.
So this is a different kind of game. This is a non-local game. This is whenever Alice and Bob are playing a game where they're not allowed to communicate. What you're thinking of is a standard game in game theory. And this, you can have superpositions. And there's this really nice paper about quantum game theory by Shengyu Zhang a couple years ago. And it's basically playing a game in superposition. So if you could talk to me later, I'll point you in that direction.
Oh,
yeah, yeah, no problem. Any other questions?
Can you briefly elaborate on how you map game into a graph and when you graph into a optimization of a cone? Does it look like this invariance with like W over
a game over a graph?
I don't know, the
quantum coloring I was talking about?
Yeah. Or not necessarily that, but in general, like if you have a quantum nonlinear game, so or any nonlinear game, you
can have a complexity
and optimization overcome.
Okay. Oh yes. So what do you have? I'll just explain with my hands. So you can explain the set of quantum correlations as a cone, a piece of a cone. Now, if you want to play a game, basically what you're doing, if you want to look at the quantum value of a game, you're optimizing the probability of winning. But what you're allowed to do is choose anything that's a quantum correlation. Alice and Bob can generate quantum correlations to win the game. So now you're looking at this set of matrices, and you're optimizing a linear function over it. And the maximum is going to be the entangled value of the game. Yeah. And before, all entangled values of games, if you wanted to look at it from an optimization point of view, usually what you had was these SDP, semi-definite programming approximations, like the almost quantum set, the NPA hierarchy, some other hierarchies. But there were never exact characterizations. So what we did, we found an exact characterization. If you solve this optimization problem, it'll give you exactly the quantum value. And it's a nice optimization problem. It's convex. It's very nice. Yeah. I can show you the slides I skipped later. But yeah. Any other questions?
Mm-hmm. So in the definition of completely positive and completely semi
positive, semi definite.
Yeah. You have these like you didn't know the size of them, basically.
That's right.
Does that just correspond exactly to like
as exactly
of,
yes. So for the completely positive cone, the size of the vectors in the decomposition correspond exactly to the size amount of shared randomness you need in a classical correlation. And likewise we're able to actually upper bound both of these quantities. You can upper bound the amount of shared randomness, and you can upper bound the amount of the size of the vectors. For completely positive semi-definite, we have no known upper bound, and equivalently in the quantum land, we have no upper bound on the amount of Hilbert space dimension. If you're able to upper bound either one of these, it would say something about the other. Yeah, so basically it's the equivalent problem, just stated in different contexts. One's just the same about matrices, and one's the same about quantum Hilbert spaces. Yeah. Yeah. There's lots of back and forth connections like that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.